Welcome back, and thanks for listening to the Coach's Playbook podcast. This week starts a three-week series called The Titans of Twitter. We will have different coaches on who have been extremely active in sharing their knowledge on Twitter. We will have two shows a week, and we'll try to release those on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Our first guest with us today will be Coach Jim Boone, who has coached men's basketball at the Division I to Division II level and has made his mark by being one of the most prominent proponents of Pac-Line defense. My teams have run some version of Pac-Line since the beginning of my career, and much of what I know I learned from driving down to watch Coach Boone's team practice and following along through his Twitter. Hope you enjoy. On today's episode, we are fortunate enough to be joined by Coach Jim Boone of the University of Arkansas Fort Smith. Coach Boone is just 29 wins shy of 600 and is currently ranked 8th nationally in wins among active coaches. Coach Boone is one of the greatest ambassadors of the game and is always willing to share and grow our game. For years, he has hosted a free clinic in which you can go down, watch his team practice. He offers a chalk talk afterward and even feeds everyone in attendance. He literally loses money to help coaches, and he's definitely changed my career for sure. He's one of the great Pac-Line enthusiasts, and we're really lucky to have him on. Coach Boone, thanks for joining the show.
Coach, you're way too kind. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk a little basketball, and particularly Pac-Line defense, which is one of my passions. So, you know, I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, this is part of the Titans of Twitter series. Coach is extremely active, and you know, for coaches interested in Pac-Line, which I'm sure a lot of the ones who are listening are, make sure you go and follow Coach Boone on Twitter. And he's got a new opportunity to get on there and learn a lot through some certification stuff. And I definitely encourage anybody to go check that out. There's so much good stuff there, and it's worth investing in yourself. But you know, Coach, with as many clinics as you work and podcasts, I know you just get worn out with questions about Pac-Line, and we are going to get there. Now, one thing I do want to get into before that, I don't know, I have the best answer, and so this is kind of a selfish question for me too, but as far as utilizing assistant coaches during games, what do you have your assistants doing specifically, and how do you communicate with them during timeouts and halftime to reconcile all that information?
Coach, really, really good question. You know, I feel like that gets back. It's kind of like facilities and how do you best use your facilities. You know, some of us have places that we've got two baskets or four baskets or six baskets, and then how many assistants do we have, and so on and so forth. And that has a lot to do with how you're going to set up your practice. And what I mean, In regards to assistant coaches, you know, everybody's a little bit different in terms of what you have available to you. I've been really blessed that we have two full-time coaches, and we generally have a student or volunteer coach. And so that's been obviously allows us to kind of do a little bit more maybe than what some people can do. What we've done and what's been really good for us, particularly because in our league, we play on Thursdays and Saturdays. And so there's not a lot of turnaround time between those two games. So we've got an assistant coach who really works on the Thursday scout and preparing for that team, while at the same time, our other assistant coach is working on the Saturday scout and preparing for that game. My focus, I try to keep my focus on our team and working on what we need to do to continue to improve and get better. But as we go into that first game, the coach that scouted that particular opponent usually sits right beside me and keeps me pretty much tuned in to what they're doing and what their tendencies are. We've already had multiple meetings with our team in regards to the scouting report. A little side note, we never hand out a scouting report. We always have our players write that in their notebook. I think that's important because it's one of the best ways to learn. We are a team that really tries to focus on our matchups, and we don't switch a lot. And so, therefore, we think our players can really dig their teeth into this is the person I'm going to be defending, and this is the closeout I'm going to have. And if they make this substitution and this player comes in, this is who I'm going to be defending. So when we get to the game, our players know, as per their substitutions and who's being played, they know who they're going to be guarding and what their tendencies are. But that's what our coach that did the scout really watches for and pays attention to, is specifically the offensive end of the floor for our opponent. Are they doing anything that's different, or an action maybe that is causing us a little bit of trouble initially that we may have to discuss how we want to defend that? But I'm a big believer in that we want to be able to teach our team, we want to give them enough tools in their tool belt that they can guard whatever the opponent throws out at them. And so we don't get caught up in plays and calls and what the opponent's doing and all that. We're just working on guarding the actions. Now, we try to have terminology our own. We call it our corporate terminology, our corporate language of what we call specific common actions that teams are going to run, so that if somebody does throw something at us, we can tell our team, well, that's a Denver, they're running a Denver, and they'll be well aware of what that is because we've covered it numerous times. Our other assistant coach is working on the Saturday scout coming up. We'll allow him to really focus on that game's our opponent, what they're doing defensively, and are they throwing anything out there, you know, from a combination defense or a matchup or a zone that we just need to be aware of. So those two guys are really focusing on our opponent, where I'm really trying to focus on our team. Our third assistant coach is logging all the fouls and timeouts that have been called, and our opponent's fouls. And we want to know how close we are to getting into bonus and when. We think that's really important. For our own team, we will play guys that have two fouls. You know, obviously they have to, we have to develop that trust in them that they can continue to do that. They can play with two without committing a third silly foul. But I think it's really important to get guys to be able to play with two fouls, because sometimes we sit guys just way too many minutes in foul trouble, and then they end up playing the second half, maybe don't play quite as well, and only end up playing, you know, 25 minutes when they're a normal guy that plays 30, 35 minutes a game. So we'll play through that. When we get to half, well, at a timeout, you ask about a timeout. So timeout, first of all, I like our two full-time assistants to have their thoughts collected. If our third assistant has something he'd like to bring up, I would prefer he bring it up to them and then allow them to bring that to me. And so the very first part of our timeout, it's quick. We're in it quick. But that very first part of the timeout, I convene with our assistant coaches on the court away from our team. And they hit me with anything they think that I need to know, or something, a suggestion they make in regards to something we should do differently. I listen to that. I try to process it, make the best decision I can, and then once we go, then I may look at one of our assistants and say, okay, great idea. You got it. You handle this timeout. Go in and cover that with our team now. And that, I think it's important. Part of my role is not only the development of our team, but the development of our coaching staff. I want our guys to want to be head coaches, and I want to put them in the best positions possible to learn as much, to cover as much, to experience as much as they can in those scenarios, that they're ready for when the opportunity comes their way. And so I like filling them in that time out where, okay, you've got this, you know, my son's one of our assistants, Jimmy. So Jimmy, all right, that's great. You got this. You handle this time out. And then at halftime, the big things for us is foul situation, opponent's foul situation. You know, are there any things that are, you know, that we need to take a look at that we can do differently? Are they hurting us with anything on either end of the floor? And the way that whole deal works is when we first enter the locker room from timeout, I'm going to address our team. And that's going to be really short and sweet. And it doesn't matter. We could be getting beaten by 20 or up by 20. I try to make it a very low, when I say low key, just very direct, not emotional. This is what we're doing well. This is what we're not doing well. And just leave them with those two thoughts. And then we depart the locker room. And that's when I meet with our coaches quickly to talk about any of the things that have transpired in that first half that we need to consider with our team. I don't like to change a lot. Occasionally we have made changes. It could be in an alignment. It could be on who we're starting the second half. We could start it entirely, or at least a different one or two guys than what we started the first half, depending on how they played. I've always been a big believer in if a guy plays well, you reward him with giving him the opportunity to play in that second half. And then we come back in and we hit them with those, you know, two, three tops things that we might want to either reemphasize or something that could be slightly new. And then let's go out and get ready to go. And so that's pretty much how we cover. I don't know if that answers your question exactly or not, but that's what's been really good for us. And yeah, that's what we do.
Yeah, that's really good. One thing that had been a common theme through my years of coaching is I've had different assistants who come and say, you know, I don't know if the kids respect me. I don't know if they, you know, if they're as receptive to me as they are you. And one thing I found is like you noted, the more positions we can put them in where they've got the attention of the team, I think that's huge. You know, letting them take a timeout is just one of the more things that builds that credibility and that buy-in with them. So. That's really good. And the other thing you mentioned about, you know, you guys just not switching. Do you feel like it helps your guys take more ownership and more buy-in? And, you know, defense should be personal, you know, in a time where it feels like not a lot of people care if people score on them. Do you think that helps some of that, you know, ownership of on the defensive end when they can key in on a matchup?
Oh, without question. And, you know, as a team, when I first started coaching, we did switch like screens quite a bit when I first started as a head coach. And we found what would happen is, you know, I'm assigned to you know, Johnny Smith, but now, and Johnny Smith is a really good knockdown, catch and shoot shooter. And now all of a sudden I switch onto a guy who's a driver. And maybe the guy that was guarding the driver now switches on to Johnny Smith, who is the really good catch and shoot guy. It's just hard in the heat of the battle to maintain the focus of guarding different guys through the course of switching their offense. And so that had a lot to do with us and our decision to not switch. And we try to avoid that at all costs, if possible, not to switch for the very reason that you outlined, because it does make it personal. It does allow our guys the opportunity to really focus in on what their man strengths and weaknesses are and how they can exploit that. And finally, obviously from a pack line perspective, that's huge for us because we want our best perimeter defender guarding your best perimeter offensive player, our best low post defender guarding your best low post scorer, and so forth. We want our best guarding your best and to maintain that matchup.
And to, you know, to utilize our assistants better. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, our resources probably aren't what yours are. I think it's great to something that we've done is, you know, especially in the bigger matchups, you know, we let our different coaches, you know, and I'll assign a specific player or two to a coach, and they'll have that individual film with the one or two or three kids that may be guarding those guys.
Yeah.
And
it's outstanding.
You know, it just allows for all that, you know, the buy-in, utilizing your assistants, but also the kids to get that, you know, that extra bit of it. So, no, I think that hits on it great, and I appreciate that. You know, let's kind of shift gears and just talk quickly about practice. I, especially as a young coach, you know, I'd go to a lot of clinics and I would see this awesome drill, you know, this great zigzag drill. If you're a pressing team, that's probably great. And, you know, we would do a bunch of this stuff that just, when I look back, I'm like, you know, I don't, that just didn't fit what we did. I mean, it looked cool. You know, it felt cool. We had a lot of energy, but we weren't really getting done what we do. And just watching you guys practice, I mean, it was just unbelievable how the practice built, how it just, it all went together. How do you think about layering your practice to get the most out of that precious time?
Well, first of all, thank you for your observation about our practice. We appreciate that. And secondly, we do work really hard, on practice. I'll tell you that right now, the basic, format or kind of how things, materialize or work, or the process is a better word, that I go through in putting the practice together is, you know, I'll watch that day's practice, that evening's practice. Usually I'll take it home with me. I'll watch it at home. And this is after, let me back up a step or two. When practice finishes, and let's start from that standpoint. When practice is completed on that day, one of the first things that I do after practice is I meet with our staff. And I think it's important that I can get them when it's still fresh in their minds. You know, and again, it's all about what did we do well? What did we not do well? What are some areas that we're really making strides forward in? What are some areas that we're not? What do we need to work on? And then I'll take the film home with me and watch it that night. And make additional notes from the staff meeting notes that we had, and I'll generate a very rough draft of what practice will be the next day. And so that morning, late morning, usually I meet again with our staff and we go through that rough draft, and they give me any ideas they may have, you know, after they've obviously watched the film as well from practice, any ideas they may have, you know, things that they think we need to do. And then I'll put together a final practice that we will then meet prior to practice and go through it every single second, every single teaching point, so that we're all on the same page, teaching the same things in the way that we want it to be taught. Now, in terms of putting that practice together, there are some core things that we want to be able to do as much as possible every day. And, you know, it's hard to do anything every day, but as much as possible, we want to spend, you know, 20 to 30 minutes of practice time on skill development in the beginning. Now, a lot of our skill development is going to materialize, because we're a motion team, into 2 and 3 man screening and cutting drills that we do during that period of time. We're usually going to do something from a team defensive standpoint that we want to work on a specific action, maybe a ball screen scenario, because we all see that now, but we see a plethora of ball screens in our league. And so we want to work on those things, particularly early on in practice, so our guys are accustomed to all of them. And then from there, we want to get things going again in practice and going really up tempo. So we have some things we call our defensive energizers, and they're mostly, you know, 1-on-0, 1-on-1, 2-on-2, high energy, high intensity, individual type drills, and we want to do those just to pick up the pace, get everybody's juices flowing, and get them ready to practice. And then from there, we'll usually cover something individual oriented in practice defensively. It'll be small groups. Maybe it'll be a 3-on-3 breakdown of ball screen defense. We want to do a lot of closeouts. I think it's important that you do closeouts and you do them from game situations. And so again, we see a lot of ball screens. So we like to set up a lot of our closeout drills as a, maybe you stunted and recovered and now you've got to close out to your man, or, you know, maybe you're in a gap and the ball is passed or skipped and you got to close out to your man. And then from there, you're playing one-on-one. And then we like to take that and move it into a team, you know, defensive scenario where we're probably working on something that, you know, a 4-on-4 or 5-on-5 scenario, whether it's conversion or ball screen defense or off ball screening, whatever it might be. And then that would move us into our team offensive segment, you know, where we're working specifically on our offensive play. And we always try to, we like to try to incorporate 10 to 20 minutes every day of 5-on-5 play. And, you know, that's the way the game is played. I think one of the things I did probably not enough as a younger coach was converting with our team. So when we do the 5-on-5 play, we're going to do it in a controlled environment. It could be offense, defense, offense. You know, where we've got, in our case, we have a blue and a white team. So we've got our blue team, you know, on offense, our white team's on defense. When white gets the rebound or the turnover or takes out the made shot, they're converting to the other end. And now blue's on defense. And then that comes right back to the same end we started on with blue back on offense. So in that particular day, maybe our emphasis was that we really wanted to work our blue offense and our white more from the defensive perspective. We'll set up small games, like, you know, we are fortunate that, you know, we have the we have media timeouts about every 4 minutes, and so we might put like 5 minutes on the clock, and we'll play a 4-minute media period. Where we don't have a lot of stoppage in terms of offense, defense, or offense to defense. It's just up and down like the game is being played. And so I try to incorporate that as much as we can. Now, in the midst of all this, we're going to have break times where in those break times, we want to utilize that as best we can. We don't want to lose that time just to stand around and BS or whatever. So, you know, we could be going hard at a 4-on-4, you know, no dribble drill, and all of a sudden we yell, pair up and shoot. So our guys are getting shots at both ends, immediately get into it. They're echoing that. They get into it, and then we go free throws. And so when we get guys, when they hear free throws, they're going to one of our baskets, and we usually practice with six goals in our arena. So they get to one of the buckets with a partner, and we're shooting two free throws at a time and rotating as our managers bring water around to them, and we're not wasting any time. A couple of things I think that are important is we like all of our individual drills to be no more than 4 or 5 minutes in length. I like our team drills to be in that 8 to 10 minute mark. We're going to disperse some quick hitting 2-minute drills. Those energizers are usually 2 to 4 minute drills in maximum in length. And then our shooting periods are usually about 5 minutes between getting shots up and free throws. But the whole focus for us is that then we're taking whatever we didn't do well that day, and we're getting a strong dose of that in the next day's practice. You know, I just think it's really important in practice that you've got to teach, you've got to make corrections. That's extremely important. But sometimes as coaches, we spend way too much time talking and not enough time of our players doing. And players learn by doing. I heard Coach Knight say many years ago that your success as a coach or your lack thereof, nothing plays a bigger role in that than that of practice. And so we want to set up practices that are intense, that flow from one thing to the next thing, that are quick in pace, that communication is high, and that, you know, that our players are really working hard in terms of the things that they're going to see in the game. The game's going to be chaotic, and that's, we want to create as much chaos in an organized manner as we possibly can. So that's some of our thoughts with practice, which for me is, again, you can tell is really important. I may write a practice, take last year's practices out per se and say, okay, this is what we did on Monday last year, so this is what we'll do on Monday this year. I think every team is different. Every team progresses at a different rate. Every team needs something different at that point in time than what a previous team did. I like to have a clean slate where I can just look at this team and say, okay, this is what we need to do. And then let's put it together and let's go to work.
That's great stuff. And I really hope, you know, there's just a lot of ways for somebody to watch your practice aside from going down. I know right now that's tough with the coronavirus, but there's even you have an all access DVD out through Championship Productions. You know, there's just a lot of ways to see it, and it's not just coach speak. I mean, you guys are the real deal when it comes to that. The practice flowing, it all matters, it all builds. It's just a great, whether you run pack line or motion, it doesn't matter. It's just great to see how the practice is run. I think it'd be worth it. One thing I know you used to, and you may still, but you used to have a dictation machine or a little voice note recorder that you had on you at practice. And I thought that was awesome. That was something that I actually went and my brother, who's my assistant, got me one. And it was just great because I found myself so many times, you know, I'd be on my drive home and I'm thinking, man, I meant to tell this kid that. I meant to do this. And it's just, and I forget all the time those little mental notes that I wanted to remember. And I think that's a neat thing for coaches to hear.
Well, I've always used one of those, and thank you for saying that. I continue to use one, and that's a great point. I think it's a great way as a head coach to stay locked in. I try to see, like, if we're doing a breakdown situation, maybe we're working on 3-on-3, you know, side ball screen, and so I want that happening on both ends of the court. We want as many people working as possible and as few people standing and watching as possible. And so we want to set up all of our drills in that manner. So in doing that, I want to be able to see both groups, and I don't really want to get distracted from one to write something down. Now, I do write notes on my practice plan from time to time, but I really like using that tape recorder just to say, you know, whatever, just to make a couple quick hitter points. And then at the end of practice, when I go back to my office, I play that and write those down. Now, I did get a little unintended consequence from that I'll share with you that I thought was awesome. There's been a few times early on when I thought I had turned the tape recorder off, and I didn't. So I left it running. And then I get in my office and I write the notes down. I realize, oh, I've got all this tape time audio recorded from practice. So I get, okay. Yeah. I get in my car and listen to the recording. And so I think one of the unintended consequences of that is you have the opportunity to hear yourself. And we need to be as clear and concise with our language and not waste verbiage. It's going to make you a better teacher to hear yourself coaching your team. And then, as you and I had already spoken about, you have a chance to really hear your interactions with your players. And there may be somebody you need to pull aside the next day and say something to that maybe you were a little harsher on than what you thought that you were when you hear it a second time. Or anyway, I just think it's a really good teaching tool. And then there are times now that I'll leave it on during practice because I just enjoy hearing our team practice, the shoes squeaking, the verbiage of our team going through practice, our coaches coaching. I think it's a great teaching tool.
Yeah, that's such a unique thing. And I would encourage people to at least try it out. I do want to talk Pac-Line. It's something I'm very passionate about.
Yeah.
It's something that I've shared with many coaches across Kentucky. And I know you're passionate about it. I think, you know, most people that are listening are high school and college coaches, so they've got a decent handle on what it is. But if you just want to give like a really brief overview of what Pac-Line is and why you fell in love with it, and then we'll start to get into some of the details and some of the wrinkles.
Yeah. I started my career as a head coach at California University of Pennsylvania. It's just outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And in a great league, really fortunate as a young coach to get the opportunity. And we were a total at that point in time. We were an on the line, up the line, deny everything, try to force the ball to the baseline, switch all like screens. And we were really good at it. But sometimes I think we were good in spite of ourselves. We saw that there were some things that were happening. Our league adjusted. We weren't getting the turnovers we had early in our career. And there was that factored into some other areas because we weren't getting the turnovers. We weren't getting the runouts offensively and the easy opportunities to score. So now we were having to work harder on the offensive end to create scoring, and it's something that we weren't used to doing until we got into league play, which you want to already have that accomplished before you get into league play. And then I took the job at Robert Morris, a small Division One school in Pittsburgh, and we inherited a great group of guys, but a really bad basketball team. And they were coming off of 5, 6, 7 consecutive losing seasons. That team had won like 4 games, 3 games the previous year. We just were not very good. And I knew we could not continue to play the way we had played in terms of pressuring the basketball, denying, switching guys. We had guys that just weren't going to be capable of guarding some of the people in our league. So anyway, make a long story short, I made the trip out to Wisconsin and spent give our team the weekend off and spent a Friday, Saturday, Sunday with Coach Bennett. He and his staff were very gracious. Coach Dick Bennett, who was at Wisconsin during that time, he was in his second year. I call Coach Bennett the father of the pack line defense. Everything we do from a pack line perspective is rooted in what Coach Bennett did. We've put our little twist to it, but it was rooted in what Coach Bennett was teaching and how he approached the pack line defense. We put it in with our team, and we've been running it for 25 years. It's been really good for us. The basic premise is really simple. We're trying to protect the lane. We're trying to keep the offense out of the lane. And in doing so, we figured out that we cannot do 3 things with our team. We cannot deny, help, and recover. That it's, if you're going to be out there, let's just say, paint a mental picture, you've got a player who is defending the wing, and he's out there in a full denial, and all of a sudden you've got a player in that guard slot at the top that drives the ball right down that slot. Is he going to leave the wing and give help there? And you know what? Players do that organically. They're going to try to give help there, whether you want them to or not. And now all of a sudden that wing slides down and the offense kicks the ball to them and they're stepping in, shooting a rhythm 3. You just can't deny and then take your momentum and go to the ball and help and then change momentum and go back and recover to a man and be able to contest a shot. So we felt like if we just put our players are off-ball defenders inside an arc that we would create and put them in help situations already. You're already in help. Your position is your help. You're not going to help. You're already in help. If we could do that with them, then we're going to stand a better opportunity, number one, to keep the ball out of paint, number two, to be able to close out to three-point shots, and consequently, what that's going to do is force the offense into hopefully shooting contested twos, and that's what we want to do. That's all we're trying to do. Now, because of our positioning, it makes you a much better rebounding team as well, because you're already in a great position to block out and rebound. And we found that by playing the pack, our three-point field goal percentage defense improves, our defensive field goal percentage improves, and our rebounding improves. And so, obviously, as I already mentioned, we've been running it for 25 years.
Yeah, I think there's a misconception out there about pack line that you give up a bunch of threes. But, you know, I try to tell coaches all the time, I think it's just the opposite. I think rotations and overhelping give up threes, and those are just things that don't happen a lot. You know, you hit it on with your terminology. Your position is your help. Once my kids, you know, when I've taken over a new program, once they understand that, and you know, that terminology is so important, you know, that your position is your help. Man, once they get that, then I think you got something cooking. And I love what you say about, you know, players can't do all those things at once. You know, I've seen it time and time again. You know, you just can't jam a square peg in a round hole. If you've got a kid who's just not very athletic and you beg them to get up the line, they get beat back door and you start hollering at them, I don't know who looks more foolish, you know. And I see it all the time. Coaches ask kids to do things they can't. And I've not in 7-8 years of running pack line have had anybody that we couldn't just, you know, you couldn't run it with. And so I love that aspect to it.
No, I would agree totally. And it's been a really good approach for us. I wouldn't do anything differently at this point in time, regardless of the level of talent. I think it's a great equalizer. It gives you an opportunity to take a lesser group and put them in a position to be very lesser athletic group and put them in a position to be very competitive. But it's a really good way to play if you have a superior athletic team. You know, you take a long athletic team and you put them already in help and in gaps, the court really shrinks. I think it's a great way to play.
That's an excellent point too. Just to build on that, I get that a lot. Some coaches that have a lot of talent or they do have some athletes. You know, I just recently took over a new job where we went from a school that we didn't have a ton of athletes to a school where we did. And I got asked over and over and over because everyone knew how passionate I was about pack line. Well, what are you going to run now? And we said, hey, we're going to run it. And I think we're going to be better. And, you know, we held teams to something like 33 points per game this year. It was 2 points lower than the rest of the state.
That's outstanding.
And, you know, and I think everybody kind of said, wow, you know, all right. You know, you can run it with whatever you've got and be great. So I love it. You know, one thing that resonates, you know, with me, and I think no matter what defense you run, both you and your players better know your nose. That's something I hear you say a lot is know your nose. You know, and I think we should be able to ask our kids those questions and they should be able to answer without hesitation if they truly are bought in. So what are the nose of what you can't not allow to be successful as a pack line team?
Quickly, just to tag on our discussion from the previous question, and you'd mentioned about your team. It reminds me of a story, and I'll get right to the heart of the story without going through the whole thing. But I'd had the opportunity to get to know Jeff Van Gundy pretty well in his younger days. And so when he was coaching the Knicks, we ended up being in a clinic together. And I was there as a attendee to hear Rick Majerus speak, and he was there as an attendee to hear Coach Majerus. And so we were able to hook up and start talking. And I asked him, I said, Jeff, you run the pack and you're coaching the Knicks. because you've got the best athletes in the world. And he said, yeah, so do they. So, you know, yeah, I think it's a great way to play regardless of your skill or talent level. It's a great way to play our game. And with the advent of the shot clock, and it's coming across the board, the shot clock aids your defense, and it particularly aids a pack line defense. Now, in regards to knowing your nose, yeah, we've got seven, and I think it's extremely important. As you mentioned, it's not just that I know them and my coaches know them, but our players have to know them, and they have to know why. The why is so important, and particularly with today's student athlete, the why is, I think, even of greater importance than it ever has been. Our first one is real simple, no paint. You know, code red, 911, keep the ball out of there. The ball cannot go to paint. Ball goes to paint, there better be consequences. You know, we've got to, you know, block a shot, get a deflection, take a charge, and worst case scenario, foul. But we're not letting the ball get to paint, giving up layups. And we are emphatic, we are not giving up layups. The second one is no baseline, which is a little different than some people, and it takes a little bit of an adjustment. Immediately, coaches say, so you force it middle. No, we do not force it middle, I should say. We do not force it middle. Well, that's just semantics. No, it's not. We're telling our players, you cannot get beat baseline. I don't want to have to deal with baseline rotations, which give up fouls. You know, I've got a big trying to rotate away from the basket and stop the ball. That's a foul scenario. That shot goes up, it's a bad shot. I've got a guard trying to rotate down and block out in a situation where maybe in my case, it's a 5'11", 6 foot guard trying to rotate down and block out a 6'8", 6'9" post. No way, no chance. That battle was won before it was fought. So let's don't put them in that position. And then we just want to be square with the ball on the wing, square with the ball on the top, keep the ball in front, no baseline, no direct drives. You got to be able to guard your yard. Cannot give up. You know, I want as much pressure on the basketball as we can get. And we just tell our players very simply, hey, you know, you put as much pressure as you can without getting beat or without fouling. We've got to put pressure, but you can't get beat. You've got to be able to give some resistance and keep the ball in front of you and not give up a direct drive. No rhythm threes. And that has to do with closeouts as well. That's all about getting there with high hands and being able to contest shots. No fast break layups. And, you know, you better have a plan on how you're going to convert defensively. In our case, we generally are sending a two men back on the rise of the shot. We've got three going to the glass, but we potentially could have four getting back on the rise of the shot. We could have five getting back on the rise of the shot, but we're not going to give up fast break layups. That's why we don't press. No second shots. And again, I don't care what you do, but you better do something in terms of blocking out. And we are a blockout team. So we teach our players that, you know, we want to hit, block out, find, and then go get the ball. And then no fouls. And we do not want to foul. We want to make more free throws than our opponents attempt. And to be able to do that, we've got to really work and emphasize in practice, we are not fouling, particularly those fouls that are out away from the basket and are just nonsense fouls. We do not want to ever foul a jump shooter, and we certainly don't want to foul a ball handler that's handling the ball 25, 30 feet away from the basket. So those are our know your nose, and to reiterate, it's really important that our team knows them and each one of them and why each one of them is so important to our play.
I think that's awesome. And it goes back to driving home that accountability piece. I think so often coaches make the mistakes of trying to hold kids accountable to things that they're not sure of. You know, if you're not really teaching something well, and kids aren't getting it, you know, it's maybe time to reflect and look back, you know, maybe it's me, maybe it's the way I'm presenting it. But, you know, I think that's just the verbs you use. Guard your yard is one we use a ton, because it paints all those pictures. It goes along with what we're trying to say and what we're trying to get done. I think another thing with, you know, with this whole pack line is, you know, kids that, I mean, offense has transitioned from everybody used to run motion and now everybody's running dribble drive, and kids are so skilled and they'll go do 750 ball handling moves and they do all these things, but can they make a next pass and can their offense touch multiple sides of the floor? And I think the answer to that a lot of times is no. And I just think pack line's a great killer. When we run it with our AAU team, heaven forbids how bad some of these poor teams look, trying to just drive into a wall. So I think that's awesome. I think this is where I am a lot different than some of the other true pack line is with high school. You know, at your level, there's no bad players. They're scholarship players. There just aren't many people with multiple glaring weaknesses. They're scholarship players. But at our level, a team is going to have one or two players out there at a time, or somebody comes off the bench that's really going to struggle in multiple areas. You know, they may not be able to handle it or finish it with their offhand. They might shoot the three under 20% or just something. But if you were coaching at the high school level, would you be a little more willing to compromise some of those no's to exploit or take advantage of those players?
That's a really good question. And I would think not. I don't think I would want to compromise any of our no's, but what we most likely would do is maybe emphasize the particular ones that fit what we're trying to take away. In other words, let's just say that we were playing a team that had a really good driving, scoring guard, and they were playing a couple of kids that just couldn't shoot the basketball. And maybe we decide to keep their players a foot in paint, really packed in paint, as opposed to being in a normal gap position. Or maybe we just keep them in that gap position. We'll do we do a drill we call 5-on-4 defense, but it's a driving drill where we have, it's a 4-on-4 setup with players, and then we either have a open player, a coach that is not guarded, that's looking to drive gaps, and so that our defense has to be in that gap and force the next pass, which is huge for us. We're constantly saying, force the next pass, outlast the offense. So that would represent that really good driving player. We're in the gap. We're not letting that player drive it by us. We're forcing the next pass, and we're getting our closeout to our man in a position we got to contest the shot. But I don't think those things, those key things that I just mentioned, those seven, that I would deviate from any of those seven. I think it's really important that we're being consistent and working on those things all the time and being the best we can be at them.
That's good. To beat the best teams, you probably don't want to get away from it too much. You may be able to pick on some other teams and some other kids, but there's probably a lot of good wisdom there and good thought there.
Well, I think that's a great point. And, that's what we're trying to do, right? We're trying to beat the best teams on our schedule. And the best teams on your schedule, you may have a couple teams on your schedule that no matter what you do, you're going to win that night. If you show up, you're going to win that night. And so it wouldn't matter if you pressed and, played zone or whatever, you're going to win that night. But you're trying to set up your team so that you can beat the best teams on your schedule. And you don't want to deviate from that for a night or two when that's who you have to be to consistently through the season to have the opportunity to be the team that can beat those best teams. So, I think that's a great point, Coach.
And I love the terminology, outlast the offense. I mean, my gosh, if you can't, if you can't grasp that, it's great. Yeah, this, at our level, and I'm sure you see it some at your level too, it just doesn't seem like teams are very patient. And I don't know if it's, you are so, you know, dribble oriented that it creates a little sense of rush as people. But, you know, I tell our kids all the time, guys, they're just not going to touch many sides of the floor. I mean, they're not. You know, if we right. face a team that is very patient, that we recognize is trying to kind of stall us, we may have to change some things, especially if we feel like we're the more talented team, because we don't have a shot clock. But typically, I mean, we just don't see it very often. I mean, it's not hard to convince people to take bad shots. And that's been probably the greatest thing about the defense for us is people taking a whole bunch of bad contested twos.
Exactly. And I do, you know, I am a big believer, and I get asked this question quite a bit. I'm a high school coach. I don't have a shot clock. What happens if a team decides to hold the ball on me? And I do think that in that case, then you probably should have an alternative defense. And I always suggest a zone defense so that you're not teaching something that is similar in nature to your pack, but is diametrically opposed to your pack, so that your players don't confuse it. And it would be some type of zone trap or what have you to play in a situation where you didn't have a shot clock.
Yeah, that's such an excellent point. I'm glad you hit on that. I did a pack line clinic for coaches, and that was one thing that was huge that I said probably was the most important thing that I've learned over the years is when you teach something that's counterintuitive to who you are, you're not going to be very good at it. And I never understood why, you know, I would tell my kids, well, you know, all right, this team, you know, can't handle it. Let's get up and pressure them. And this team who can't handle it is driving around and shooting layups. And I'm like, man, it was just counterintuitive to everything we were. So I think that's an excellent point. This last segment, Coach, always the last segment we do, I'm going to throw a full court press on you. You're going to have 10 seconds or less to answer some rapid fire questions. You ready?
Yeah, let's go.
All right. Does high school need a shot clock?
I'm a proponent of not having a shot clock, and I know I'm in a vast minority. I am a traditionalist. I love the game when you had to play against every facet of the game to be a championship team. One night I got to play against a team that presses and runs. The next night I might have to play against a team that wants to hold the basketball open, God forbid. And, you know, the next night I might have to play a team that's going to zone me. But I got to face all gambits of the game. And as a purist, I love watching teams have to work to score and having work to play. Now, it's coming. Everybody's going to have it. As I mentioned earlier, it's a benefit to our defensive play. So be it. We're prepared for it, but I'm not a big proponent of it.
Oh, God bless you, Coach. You're about the 10th college coach we've had on, and you're the first one to say no. So the high school coach.
Oh, I know. And I'll get criticized immensely for that, but I've got a lot of really good friends, high school coaches in our area, and they want the shot clock so bad they can't stand it. Be careful what you wish for, but
yeah. All right, if you're up three with 7 seconds to go and the ball's at half court and they have it, are you going to foul or do you play it out?
We're playing it out. And the reason we're doing that is because we are a defensive that's our priority. You know, we emphasize our defensive play. We hang our hat on our pack line defense. And how can we do that if I'm then going to tell my team that we're going to foul in this situation? I have found through the years that I think that we're in a much better position to win the game if we do not foul and we play it out. Knock on wood, hopefully it doesn't happen. We've never lost a game. In my 34 years as a head coach, we've never lost a game that we played it out. We have had a couple where they hit a desperation three and sent it to overtime. Fortunately, in the overtime, we won. But that's only happened like one or two times in my entire career. But we've always played it out from day one.
Man, those are good numbers. Favorite gym you've ever coached in?
Mine. playing at home in the stubble field. It doesn't get any better than that. I will say that when I was at Cal, you know, my very first game coaching there in their old facility, which is called Hamer Hall, I walked out there. I bet you there wasn't 200 people in the stands. And by year 7, 8, 9, and 10, we sold out every single home game. and it was an unbelievable venue to play a home game in, to play a regional game, kind of a little bit like you'd mentioned it. Your wife, I think, had played at Bellarmine. I love their place. I love those old gyms. So I'd say maybe Hamer as my second one, but my home court can't get much better than Allen.
Great answer. Least favorite person to coach against?
I'm going to say Jeff Berkhammer. Jeff Berkhammer is a great friend. We've served on the same staffs together. I was in his wedding. We've maintained a great friendship throughout the years. And for 4 years, or 4 or 5 years, he still is the head coach at West Florida University. When I was at Delta State, we had to compete against each other. And that was miserable. If you won, you felt bad. And if you lost, you felt bad. Don't like playing against really good friends, and certainly did not enjoy playing against Jeff's teams because he does an outstanding job himself, and he does an outstanding job, and just such a good friend.
That's good. I'm dreading if I ever have to coach against my brother because I already know who my mom's going to be cheering on, and it'll break my heart. So I can imagine.
Yeah, that's a tough one. That's a tough one.
If you follow Coach Boone on Twitter, then you know he is a pit master. All right, you get one final meal. What kind of meat are you smoking, and what basketball coach are you inviting over?
Well, you know, I kind of thought about this a little bit. You told me this might be coming my way, and it's a tough one because there's so many guys that I would love to have dinner with, from a Rick Majerus to a Bob Knight to a Dick Bennett. Guys that have been influential in my career. But I'll have to say, if I had one person to have dinner with, and it's going to set up what I would cook for that evening, it would be Coach Don Meyer, who was a good friend that we lost a few years back to cancer. There's nobody that gave more to coaches and did more for our game than what Coach Meyer did. I miss him tremendously. So to have the opportunity to spend an evening with him would be, I just don't know if he'd ever get any better than that. And I would do a pork butt, and we would have pulled pork sandwiches because that was one of Coach's favorite barbecue items.
That's awesome, Coach. Hey, you were fantastic. And I can't thank you enough for taking your time out. Nobody, you know, in my opinion, nobody does more for coaches than you do. And we're all thankful for having you around. So we really appreciate you, Coach.
Coach, thank you very much. It was great spending time with you. All the best. Hopefully we'll all get back to doing what we love to do as soon as possible, and move past the coronavirus and put it in our rearview mirrors.
Amen. We'll see you.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
For Coach Boone, this has been Wyatt Faust, and thanks for listening to the Coach's Playbook podcast. Join us again on Thursday as NBA and college skills trainer Joey Burton joins us to talk about skill development and how we can improve our players. Until then, keep getting better.